The Buzz Podcast, helping smart businesses be even more innovative.
Hi, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Welcome to episode number 79 of the InnovaBuzz Podcast, designed to help smart businesses with an interest in innovation become even more innovative. In this episode, my guest is Christy Faulkner of Womenkind, a marketing communications company focused on branding and marketing to a women's audience. Christy is a very insightful person, very passionate about bringing empathy to advertising and marketing and removing stereotyping from it. Now, this was a really fascinating interview where we talked about topics ranging from the stereotypes in the conservative advertising industry and why brands need to be empathetic in marketing, and even topics such as shaving legs. Now, you have to listen to the podcast to find out how all those things are related. Without further ado, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Christy Faulkner of Womenkind. Hi, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to have with me today on this episode of the InnovaBuzz podcast, all the way from the other side of the world in Manhattan, New York City, in the USA, Christy Faulkner, the co-founder and president of Womenkind. Welcome to the podcast, Christy. It's a privilege to have you here.
Oh, I'm so delighted to be talking to someone from Australia.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? We can use technology to talk all around the world just at the press of a button.
It's amazing, yes.
Yeah.
Who invented that?
That's
whose
right.
Innovation was that? Whose big idea was that?
Yes, well, I think there was a guy called Bernard Lee. Al Gore, yeah. I think it was Bernard Lee that was accredited officially with it, though. All right, so Womenkind is a marketing communications company with the expertise to create strategic marketing programs that speak specifically to women and connects women with brands. So I'm really fascinated to find out about that, because obviously as a man, it's not necessarily one of my strong points. So now a big shout out to Lolly Daskal, because Lolly introduced us and suggested we get you on the podcast. So thank you for that, Lolly. And I'm really looking forward to talking with you today, Christy. So tell us, before we talk about branding and everything that you're doing at Womenkind, tell us how you got into this business.
Okay, well, back in the day, and I don't really want to date myself, but I grew up I grew up in Texas, and let's just say it was the early 90s, and I was very creative, you know, sort of artistically, and I like to write, and I like to solve problems, although I wouldn't have described it that way when I was 20, but in those days, there weren't really a lot of options for creative people the way there are now. I mean, you know, you could probably go to Hollywood, or you could maybe go to work for a publisher or a magazine or advertising. That, you know, that was sort of the basic spectrum of the creative business, as it were. And that's changed dramatically now. I mean, actually, the industry of advertising is actually having a hard time attracting young people to it, because there's a plethora of creative industries nowadays. Even, you know, coding is a creative industry. So so I came to New York out of college to work on Madison Avenue, and I started a very big Madison Avenue global advertising agency, and I did that for about 15 years. And I started to notice that there were very few women in leadership, very few women in a creative department. It turns out at the time there were less than 3% of creative directors were women. And I had a couple of babies, and I started to, you know, really think about my career, what I wanted to do. But most important is I was sitting in a meeting one day. We were talking about shaving, women's shaving habits. And I looked around the room, and I saw that the client was a guy, the head of research was a guy, the head of accounts was a guy, and the executive creative director was a guy. And there were a couple of scattered junior women from the account group in the room, and my partner and I, and we looked at each other and said, why are campaigns for women created by men? What is wrong with that? And we started to think, you know, maybe there's a market here, and this idea that you know, women women's sensibilities, which are entirely different than men's, obviously. That's not new news. But what if we could bring a woman's sensibility to marketing to women? Would it make a difference? Would it help move the needle? And at the time, most advertising to women was either sexist. Women, you know, women were always sex pots, or they were mothers. And there wasn't a lot of dimension there. So we decided we would start a strategic marketing company, not just an agency, but a real marketing partner for clients who needed to reach, engage, persuade women. So that's what we started. And I'll tell you something, Jürgen. You know, like many ideas, when you have them, you decide, you know, it was breakthrough at the time. There was no agency. There were some research companies and there were some creative agencies, but there was no real company that did it all, from insight to execution, we call it. And as I was saying, when you have a new idea and it's kind of innovative, you never know if it's going to soar or fall flat. And we had a pretty good idea that it would soar. And while it didn't fall flat, it was much harder to convince clients that they needed women working on their business than we thought. Now, that was, you know, 2008. So things have started to change a little bit in terms of brand marketers realizing that gender stereotypes don't work anymore, and women are the world's most powerful consumers. So there's starting to be more clients realizing that it's important to have diversity in the innovation team.
I'm a little surprised by that, quite frankly, because, you know, the example you mentioned about women's shavings products, and I read something recently about pantyhose, and I don't know whether it was one of your blog posts or that it was just serendipitous that I came across this, but it was along the same lines that, there are a whole bunch of guys that were putting together the promotional and marketing material for women's pantyhose, and probably none of them have ever worn women's pantyhose, or if they had, they wouldn't admit to it.
Oh my goodness. So you're gonna, let me give you a funny example about the shaving. So we were launching for a very big company, a line of shavers for women. It was basically the man's razor in a pink, with a pink handle. And the head of research said, okay, we've done our $1 million study of, you know, however many hundreds of thousands of women, and it's become very, very clear, almost 100% of women responded to the question the same way. And the question was, if you knew you were going to have sex, would you shave your legs? And almost 100 women said yes, and that's the big idea. And my partner and I stared at him and said, are you kidding me? And they were, you know, all the guys in the room were, well, of course, that's why women shave their legs, because they know they're going to have sex. We're like, oh my goodness, that is not why women shave their legs. But it was like, you know, you take a factoid and you put it through the filter of a guy who's never shaved his legs, probably, and something different comes out than women's own experience and women's own intuition. So
yeah, well, I mean, again, I am a little surprised by this, and I'll tell you why. I mean, I shave my legs, but I do it for a different reason. And it's not about sex. I'm a cyclist.
They need you on the account.
Yeah, well, I'm a cyclist, so I shave my legs, and I do use men's razors, although I have borrowed my wife's and got into trouble for doing so. But the point I guess I'm making is, you know, in a marketing sense, making an assumption, what's behind the need, and then just doing that one-dimensionally is, that's the bit that surprises me. I mean, yes, you know, as a man, to try to understand what motivates women in, you know, some fairly personal things is difficult, and I understand that that's obviously going to be much better served by women advertising or marketing executives, but that it's so one-dimensional. What was happening before, that really stuns me. So it does highlight that there was a big need, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And
we saw the need. I'm not sure the rest of the market saw the need at the time, because it was a very hard sell for the first few years we were in business trying to convince.
Well, how much How much of that was, because you do mention the Boys Club of Medicine Avenue, how much of that was entrenched, what's the word, misogynism or?
Mm-hmm. But you know what, I wouldn't call it misogyny, although there's probably an element of that. More so, I think it was just unconscious bias. I think, you know, advertising was a man's business for a long, long time. In many ways, it still very much is. And yet women are, as we know, the world's most powerful consumer. You know, it's lots of statistics, but 85% of purchases are influenced by women. And that goes across beer, you know, cars, computers, all kinds of stuff. So there's definitely a gap there that, you know, basic Madison Avenue hasn't really stepped up to yet. Although there is, while there may not be gender parity in the advertising industry and in agencies in particular yet, at least there's now a lot more awareness of stereotypes and bias. You know, agencies still make huge, huge mistakes. Clients still make huge, huge mistakes, but they're much more aware now. And, you know, the consumer has such a powerful voice now through social media. They're very quick to react.
Yeah.
You saw what happened with Pepsi. People were outraged instantly. And the outrage went viral more so than the ad going viral. And so we really have to be sensitive. And I think that's part of what's driving brands to be conscientious now and really look for their bias. You know, bias often is a blind spot. So at least now we're having a conversation about these things, whereas in the early 90s, nobody was talking about, oh, we don't have any women on our business, or, oh, what about the stereotype of women just wanting sex so they shave their leg? You know, that wouldn't happen today, at least I hope. But mistakes still happen, as I mentioned about Pepsi. So it's unfortunate, but we are getting better.
Yeah,
I think that's a major innovation.
Yes, I agree with you. I guess it comes back to, I'm doing some work with Seth Godin through one of his mastermind groups at the moment, and he really hammers home the point about empathy and marketing. You know, being empathetic, getting into the mind and the shoes and whatever you like of the client, but you know, not in the kind of, what is it, the classic textbook way that people tell you, you've got to get into the mind of the client, but really empathetic and, you know, to the level of what does the client believe that I don't believe, and why do they believe that, and where does that come from? So that, I think that's where the power is in that kind of empathy.
Absolutely. And fantastic that you're working with Seth. He's definitely one of my heroes. I've read most all of his books and his blog quite regularly, and he's brilliant. But on the point of empathy, I think the kind of counterpoint to empathy is indifference. And this is what we talk to our clients about when we create campaigns, is that if you're going to be indifferent to your consumer, they're going to be indifferent to you. Mm-hmm. And so the only way, it's reciprocal. Right. So if we're empathetic in terms of just listening to our target, we spend a lot of time at Women Kind talking to women, trying to figure out the multiple dimensions of what they're communicating. Because, you know, women are very complex, which is not to say they're not straightforward, but sometimes there's subtext to something that they're communicating. And women communicate multi levels all the time. And so we really have to dig to be empathetic, because if you're indifferent to the depth and the complexity of a woman, or frankly any target, then you're going to end up with something that's a stereotype and that's very superficial. So empathy is so important. Empathy and its twin sister, gratitude, I think. And that is really showing appreciation for that audience's point of view. You know, and you can see in campaigns, even whether they're in social or digital or television or what you can see when there's no, when there's a lack of empathy and a lack of gratitude. I mean, we, especially now, because we don't have captive audiences anymore, we have to show gratitude for the attention that the audience is lending us. And we have to earn their attention more than ever before. So we need to be grateful for having that attention by showing them respect, by paying attention to their real needs, by trying to understand their hopes, fears, desires, and intentions. And so, yeah, I see empathy and gratitude as going hand in hand.
Yeah, good point. I like it. So you started a business in New York in Madison Avenue straight out of university.
No, well, yes, I started at a big agency. I worked at pretty much all the big agencies that you can think of. I worked at around Madison Avenue and then started Womenkind in 2008, that halcyon period right before the greatest crash of all time.
Yeah, that was a great time to start a business. I lived through that myself. I think if you start a business in the one of the biggest depressions that we lived through, I guess, and survived and come through the other end, then you're probably doing pretty well.
Well, yes, and fortunately, that's when I had time to read all of Seth's books.
Okay, yeah.
I had nothing else to do.
Yeah. Okay, and so tell us a little bit then about what you do at Womenkind, because I'm fascinated. You know, there's a lot of measures, proprietary measures that you've developed that you talk about on your website, which help you develop that understanding, how to motivate women, mm-hmm. you know, what drives them, how to research, how to engage with them, and how to take that listening and actually translate it into a message that then will resonate with them.
Sure. So our core value here at Womenkind, and I think it's just a core value of creative people everywhere, but it's curiosity. Mm. We are really, really deeply curious about a product, about a service, a company, and most importantly, we're really curious about our target, our audience. And so we want to know a lot about her. So one of the first questions that we asked ourselves is, we felt like it's not enough to be a woman to understand women. And we could never just profess that expertise because we're women. That would be absurd in any category. So the first thing we said, well, what makes women different? Why is a female target distinctly different from a male target? And, you know, all the years I was on the Madison Avenue, we would have, you know, we'd get a brief from a client with the stated objective of a campaign. And very often the objective is to reach the mass. Well, a mass audience is a male audience, unfortunately, in terms of the way it's interpreted. And it was always like, you know, like, are men going to like this? I mean, that's why you see beer advertising that looks like it does, even though women buy a lot of beer. So, because mass means men. So we set out to say, okay, how are women really different from men? And the first thing we did was we researched very thoroughly all the extant data points that go from Darwin. We started with Darwin all the way up to, like, you know, men are from Mars, women are from Venus. I mean, literally everything we could that talked about the differences between men and women. And it's a study we call Women Tuition. And it basically distinguishes everything. Like, I mean, we looked at politics and brain chemistry and human sexuality and hormones, I mean, everything. And this study, it's actually a very cool 2-hour presentation. If you're ever in New York, stop by and I'll show it to you. Mm-hmm. But it really does talk about the differences between men and women. And it starts to give you a sense of why women have to be communicated with differently. You know, and it's everything from the way we hear. You know, women have a more keen sense of hearing than men do. You know, I mean, you take a couple asleep at night, the baby cries. The woman might wake up instantly and the man may never hear it. It's just the way we've evolved. The most sensitive man's skin is still not as sensitive as the least sensitive woman's skin. So if you're a car manufacturer, you might want to think about the kind of upholstery you use. I mean, these differences have effects and consequences in almost everything we create and everything that we communicate to women. And so we really understand that, and that serves as the foundation for everything we create. After that, we have another study that's very proprietary. It's called the Blind Spot Benchmark. And that arose, again, from just curiosity. The question is, why is it that there's so much market research, to an audience, and then yet still a piece of creative or a message can be so off the mark? So what's the blind spot here? What is it that ordinary research misses in communicating with an audience? And what we realized is that there are very big blind spots in certain brands because they don't look for the way women want to relate or have a relationship with the brand. It's the lack of empathy, frankly, and that's where the blind spot comes from, is they're thinking about what we want to say instead of what she wants to hear. And what was very interesting about that study is that we benchmarked it in just a couple of categories in the beginning. And what we saw was that older women, so boomer women, expect a lot less from a brand and brand's communications than millennial women. Younger women, it really went on a continuum. So from boomers to Gen X to millennials, it was very distinct how younger women are much more naturally empowered. You know, women outperform men academically, generally speaking. So a woman, and yet when they get to the workforce, it starts to change. And there's a lot of reasons for that, which we don't have to go into. Mm-hmm. But that changes the way a woman perceives how she's communicated with. So in other words, in school, and I'm speaking very generally, but when you're a young woman, you're in a meritocracy and things are very balanced. If you perform better, you can outperform, say, the boys in your class. And so you're very close to that feeling of feeling empowered and equal. So those women who are closer to that experience expect respect from brands and in fact demand it. However, women who are much older and have had more life experience, especially, you know, boomers who came up in a different time when things were very different, they expect a lot less. We describe it as having learned indifference, and that is they don't get annoyed every time, you know, they're insulted or a sexist comment is made. It would just be too exhausting. So they just learn to be indifferent to it. They choose their battles, so to speak. So those women, you know, with an eye roll and a boys will be boys thing, they expect less from brands, but millennials won't have it. And so that was very interesting to us. So in terms of a brand's blind spot, they were able to get away with it for a lot longer than they could today with a younger audience who has a different perspective. And if you look at ads from 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago, you'll see what I mean. The sexism is shocking ad in the 80s to someone like, you know, my daughter. Shocking. Yeah, she's like, how could this have run?
Not just the advertisement. I mean, some of the television shows I saw, there was a recently, I saw just a clip of something here because there was a 50-year anniversary, or I'm not sure it was 50 or something like that, of television here, and it was cringeworthy, really. And I thought, boy, did I watch that? And I thought, oh, well, I was a teenager then, so maybe I did. But, yeah.
It's I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. It's interesting, though. I mean, I totally agree with you because, you know, I know when I went through school, all the smart cookies in class were the girls, right? So there were half a dozen girls that were absolutely, I mean, I admired them because they were just, you know, brilliant. And I was kind of driven and wanted to achieve, but I could never quite get the academic results that they did. And then when you get out in the workforce, all of a sudden it's just this male-dominated society. And you're right, because those people that grew up in that era, the women have kind of been conditioned then to accept that and kind of dismiss it and live with that. Although I think that's changing a lot. I think with the, you know, the younger generation coming up, and I know, you know, my own daughter and other, you know, her friends and people that I deal with there in that generation who've come up and, you know, who've experienced that transition into the workforce where women are much more valued and given much more equal rights, if you like, or, you know, equal opportunities. It's still a way to go, but I think the expectation with the older women has changed a little bit. And I hear, particularly in Australia, I hear a lot of outrage from right across the generations when, you know, there is something that you look at and you go, oh, that's just cringeworthy. So I wonder if it's changing across the board a little bit. I hope it is.
Well, you know, progress is slower than some of us would like. But I want to caution our listeners about what we perceive as progress. So, for instance, there's been a very big trend in the last few years in what I call, you know, fempowerment advertising. So we're starting to see more messages about rah-rah women, look how strong you are, you're so empowered, things like that, you know, messages like that. And we did some very interesting research with a financial services client that we were working with on basically how to talk to women about money in this new empowered environment. Like, were their attitudes about their financial life evolving along with empowerment? And it was fascinating to us because the feedback that came back, and we did research with about 1,100 women, and the feedback came back was the two most hated words in marketing to women. The first is empowerment. And women said, you know what? You don't empower me. Your lipstick doesn't empower me. I am empowered. Yeah. I empower myself. And so the fact that you, brand, tell me that you can empower me suggests that you're superior to me. And I don't need your empowerment. Thank you very much. The second word is confidence. And again, your shampoo doesn't give me confidence. Your lipstick doesn't give me confidence. I give me confidence. Confidence comes from within. So again, while women aren't, you know, picketing, you know, against these campaigns or getting too riled up, they're just annoyed. They're just annoyed because it perpetuates the stereotype that we need to be empowered and that we are somehow not confident. And also, if you look at men's advertising, you never see the word empowerment with men. We never talk about how, you know, this, whatever, this shampoo empowers you guys, this toilet paper empowers you. Yeah, yeah. It just doesn't happen.
Well, the advertisement for the men is pretty base, right? Use this shampoo, you get the girl, right?
Which is pretty
sexist. And I have to tell you, I'm kind of offended like that as well, because I guess I react the same way. I feel, okay, if there's a girl I like, I'm happily married, by the way, so this is a hypothetical. If there's a girl I like and you know, she likes me and we get on and there's a relationship, I don't need a shampoo or something as a crutch to make that work, right? It's up to me and it's up to the other person. But
and you make a very good point, because stereotypes offend everybody.
Yeah.
And should offend everybody. And it's very difficult. It's a real challenge. And we talk about innovation here. It's a real challenge for brand marketers and creative people to not resort to stereotypes. I mean, that was what part of the big stink was about the Pepsi debacle last month, is that, you know, it was crawling with stereotypes that, you know, certain creators of that work didn't even see. So again, it goes back to empathy. Let's be empathetic. You know, do I really want to convince you that your shampoo is going to help you get the girl?
Yeah.
That's not an empathetic message at all.
It isn't, no. And it's still, you know, you still see a lot of that. I mean, you look at car advertisements today, it's still, you know, the expensive cars, you know, they're still doing the philosophy, you're not after a quality machine that drives fast and is comfortable or something, you're after status and you're after the girl.
Well, know, and that's and the, and the again, cars. It's a ridiculous stereotype. Mm. How many times do you see a woman driving a car?
Mm.
Have you ever, Jurgen, exactly. Have you ever seen a woman driving a car and the man in the passenger seat?
Once or twice, yeah.
Well, then you're much more evolved in Australia than we are here. It doesn't happen.
Well, in the advertising.
Yes, in the advertising.
Right. Yeah, not sorry.
In real life. Sorry. In real life, it happens all the time, right?
Well, but yeah. Not in ads. Yeah. I think in real life, you'd probably be looking at some statistics that were fairly balanced, I would imagine.
Yes.
Done a study. But, yeah, you know, and the other thing, I mean, maybe this is just my perception, but if I see expensive cars driving on the road or, you know, fast cars or luxury cars, it's almost more often than not that there's a woman at the wheel. And so, right. You know, you wonder, well, why are they advertising to men?
So I was at a conference a couple of years ago. It was a luxury marketing conference. And I think it was the CMO of Mercedes got up and he was talking about their product and, you know, I mean, it's a wonderful car.
Hmm.
And he showed the ad that had Kate Upton, the supermodel, in cutoff short shorts, soaping up, you know, in a bikini top, soaping up a Mercedes.
Hmm.
And the guys are, you know, are walking by and they don't know who to look at first, the car or her, because they're both so hot. And he was very, very proud of this ad. And you know what? I don't know how this ad actually performed in marketing. I'm sure it was successful for them. It was on the Super Bowl. They spent millions and millions of dollars on it. You know, and I asked him, do women buy your car? Because where I live, most of the Mercedes are driven by women.
Hmm.
And he was like, of course women buy our car. And I said, well, why does your ad look like that? And it was almost like he didn't know what I mean.
Hmm.
It was almost as if he said, but you know, it was almost, he didn't say this and I'm inferring it. So I'm putting words in his mouth, I admit. But the impression I got from the conversation was that's not who we make the ads for. You know, we make the ads for the car loving guy.
Hmm.
And it's like, but what can you think of any products that are marketed, quote unquote, to people other than the people who buy them?
That's right. I mean, you have to ask like just an accountant type question and say, well, if you're doing that advertisement, the supermodel probably comes fairly expensive. The, mm-hmm. you know, the people that did the film and everything would have been top notch and expensive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Running it in the Super Bowl would have cost millions, I imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all marketing to men. And then what's your target market breakdown? Or what's your market, your real market breakdown? And if it's 50-50 men and women, well, hang on. You're selling half of your cars to an audience that doesn't even relate to those advertisements at all. So why are you spending money on one half of the market to get X return and you're getting the same return effectively from another part of the market where you're spending nothing.
Right. Right. And so there's this phenomenon, and this is what I think has plagued Madison Avenue for many, many years. It's guys creating ads to impress other guys.
Mm.
And that was a problem that I had working in, you know, a big agency. And we're talking about, you know, creative departments with a couple hundred people. It was a challenge because the guys I worked with, and I, you know, I'm a junior copywriter and I'm an associate creative director, like at those levels. So the guys got to work on beer and cars, and the women got to work on, you know, tampons, pantyhose, and shampoo and baby diapers. And then what would happen is the ads, the really great ads, the creative directors were most proud of, the creative director guys who would go to the Cannes Film Festival or whatever, would be the car and the beer ads. So then those guys would win awards because the diaper ad never wins awards, right? so the Mercedes ads or whatever with the supermodels would win the awards because, oh, by the way, the guys judge the award shows too.
And then
those guys would come home with awards and get promoted and then be our boss. And the women, you know, like I worked on J&J, for instance. All of my clients at J&J at the time were, you know, Ivy League MBAs, really brilliant people. And, you know, you couldn't bring a skateboarding dude who just did the award-winning beer campaign. You could not bring that guy to a meeting at J&J and expect him to hold court with, these really brilliant marketing minds. You couldn't do it. I mean, these were top-notch people. And so, you know, they sent the dignified women over to the client to have the meetings. And yet, like I said, the woolly hat wearing skateboarding dude is my boss now. And yeah. It was enormously frustrating as a woman to be in an agency that time. And that's why, frankly, a lot of women would leave. It would just be like, this is unfulfilling and I'm not being heard. And what's the point? So, you know, and I started that, there were no women over 40.
And that makes changing that whole environment more difficult, right? Because the people that think it's wrong and want to change it, they get frustrated because they're unable to and they leave. And they do their own thing.
Again, it's innovative thinking, right? I mean, we are a creative industry. We should be on the cutting edge in every possible way, and we're just not.
Hmm. I mean, it sounds like the primary driver in that part of the industry was winning awards, winning film awards that were judged by people that were looking for that kind of rubbish.
Yeah. Well, you're right, and it's kind of a closed feedback loop. And as I said, guys creating fun ads for guys. And you know what? I was at Cannes, let's see, 2 years ago when Like a Girl swept the awards. And it was a fantastic campaign and all of that. Completely support that message. But it was the first year that I believe they gave out this, it was Sheryl Sandberg from Facebook fame. They had a new category of ads there that they were going to give this crystal award to. It was a very beautiful feminine award, and it was for the best advertising to women. And when I went through the gallery to look at the work, and I was very excited, Jürgen, because I specialize in women. I wanted to see what was being, you know, it's a major showcase of ads from around the world, campaigns, all different kinds of campaigns, not just ads. But I was very excited to be inspired by what marketing to women was going to accomplish around the world. And when I got to the gallery to see the work, I was so stunned that virtually every ad in the category was a public service announcement. So it was the anti-rape campaign. Mm. It was the clean water, you know, it was the women, you know, just atrocities that happened to women around the world. So the campaigns were brilliant. They were moving. They were effective, I'm sure. But yet none of them, as I recall, were for a commercial product to sell stuff. It was activism. And I thought, you know, to myself, there's something really ironic about the power of women as activists. And when you have an important issue, you have to tap into women. You know, there's all these studies that in Africa, you know, women, you give a dollar to a woman in Africa and she feeds her family, and you give a dollar to a man, that may not happen, let's just say. And there's a lot of studies around that, which is why a lot of microfinancing is directed to women and whatever. So my point is that there's a lot of seriousness. When you have a serious issue, you turn to women to help resolve it. But when you're selling Mercedes, all of a sudden women aren't who you want to be talking to. And I still am stunned by that kind of sexism, frankly.
Hmm. Yeah. All right.
Is that a downer? I'm sorry to be a downer.
No, not at all. I'm just thinking, you know, we could talk about this, go on and talk about this for a long time, because it's really fascinating. And I think you know, it's a good point that, you know, the I mean, I wonder with the all the films that you saw, you know, the vast majority being activism. I mean, there are two thoughts going through my mind. One is, you know, are women more vocal or more, you know, concerned about looking after others, looking after the community, and so are they more likely to be putting out that sort of work in that kind of environment, in that kind of competition? Or is it a sign of our times because there's so much of that nasty stuff going on, you know, directed against women in our society that we have to address, you know, and that men aren't stepping up to the plate yet and saying, hey, you know, this stuff's going on, we need to change this, it has to stop. So, you know, is it a bit of those things?
You know, you're hitting on it. It's enormously complex. It's enormously complex. But if I were to boil it down, I would say that women are really powerful. So they're powerful economically, and they're powerful forces of change. And that power is not always recognized or celebrated the way it could and should be.
Hmm.
And in fact, when we talk about that, we talk about empowering them versus recognizing the power.
Exactly.
That
yeah. And, you know, in my mind, I mean, you talked earlier about empowered, that, you know, I mean, I empower myself. I don't, nobody else does it for me. And talking empowerment as let's empower women and so on, it kind of has the opposite effect, right? It's actually disempowering and subtly sending that message that unless I empower you, you're not empowered.
Right. I'll say if you're empowered or not.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, you know, but as somebody said a while back, you know, when did empowerment become something you had to buy?
Yeah. All right. Well, this is a fascinating discussion. And as I say, I could go on for ages on this, but I'll come back to advertising and the creative process, because running actually in an hour's time, I'm going live on the Business Systems Summit, which is a global summit on businesses and processes. And one of the things that is fascinating to me is systemizing the creative process. And I know I've, you know, it's something that I've done in the past with research of new ideas, but typically creatives tend to say, no, I can't run systems and processes because I need creative freedom. So you got any thoughts on that?
Oh my goodness, Jürgen, I have so many thoughts about this. So first of all, as a creative person, so in our the way we work is we get a brief, and the brief, it basically states the objective and the target and what's the point of difference of a product, you know, what makes us unique, and then it becomes incumbent upon the creative person to interpret that and put it through their creative mind and spit out a great idea or a solution to the problem, or, you know, something that's maybe unexpected but solves it. And that's the magic, right? I think that a super tight brief is a luxury. And I think the creative process is so much more enhanced when the brief is tight, when the box is tight, when you have to think in a very tightly constructed situation, set of problems, that's where creativity, that's where, to me, where the magic happens. That's where the big idea happens. Do you remember in that movie, Apollo 13, you know, Houston, we have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
There was a crisis on the spacecraft, and they back at NASA, somebody brings in a bag of various parts and tools and stuff and dumps it on the table, and they say, these are all the things we have on the ship that can solve this problem. How are we going to solve it?
Yeah.
And so that in a way was a tight brief. It was like, you know, we have these 12 items, these 12 random parts that are up there in space, and we have to solve this big problem. And how are we going to make these items into a solution? And that's the way I think about a creative brief, like make it as tight as possible. Make the, you know, because look, if you said, just do anything you want, you know, we would spin our wheels as creative. And furthermore, it's the tighter you are. First of all, let me back up and say, I think a problem well stated is partially solved. And I think most often, if you spend your creativity trying to state what the problem is, it leads you to a greater solution. So if you can be very tight about that, I just think that the possibility of answering the problem and also having a litmus test, so to speak, or a standard by which you judge the solution to the problem comes from defining the problem really well. So I'm all for process and limitations, you know, throw them at me.
I love that. Yeah, I love what you said there about spending, you know, a large chunk of your creative energy on defining the problem. And I remember when we first trialed this, and this is back in my corporate days, this process for, you know, a research process, and we spent, we had a test project that had a deadline of 3 months, and we spent the first 6 weeks defining the problem and the issue. And people were saying, oh, we need to get to work, was what I kept hearing. We need to get to work because time is running out. It's six, we've got 6 weeks there already, or probably 3 weeks in. I was hearing, we need to get to work. You know, we've almost done a month and there's only 3 months to do this. And I said, well, until we know what we're doing, there's no point in getting to work, as you call it, because we are working on defining the problem. So, yeah, I love it.
It's so true. You know, very often I have clients come and they say, we say, what's your challenge? And they'll say something like, well, we need to sell more product. Hmm. You know, the problem is we're not selling enough product. Well, that's not the problem, probably. Yeah. So, but sometimes, you know, that's the most people can, you know, they're looking at the consequence or the symptom versus
that's right.
the real
yeah.
problem.
I'm going to say that's one of the symptoms. They're probably yeah, not absolutely. The only symptom.
Right. And we always say here, measure twice, cut once.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great saying. All right. Well, what do you think is the biggest trap innovators or creatives encounter when they're endeavoring to sell their new ideas?
I think, well, in selling the idea, I think it's storytelling. I think that we spend a lot of time thinking, producing, coming up with something, you know, and then we go and present it. And then often, because we're so deep in it, we see the solution as being self-evident and we forget to tell the story. And so I think stories are what connect us to one another. You know, stories are where the empathy is. And I think that, you know, any innovator needs to be able to tell the story of the product or the solution. You know, lead someone through the not necessarily the process, but the story of the need and why this is the solution. And really guide, when you're talking about selling it, you're really guiding that buyer, whoever that buyer may be, whether it's your consumer or your client, you're really guiding that buyer through your vision of why you approached that thing. And I don't think it doesn't have to be a creative wow story. But it doesn't have to be too simple either. It doesn't have to be too pedantic. But I think just the storytelling aspect is the biggest challenge.
Mm. Yeah, that's really great. I'm doing a lot of content marketing, and I'm always trying to get back to, you know, what's the story, what telling the story. And I see there's a lot of people now that specialize in, you know, storytelling as a marketing tool, if you like. And that's really fascinating. And those people that do it well are really great.
Well, and the story, this storytelling is a fantastic tool for engaging anyone in anything. I mean,
that's right,
think about when you go to a dinner party, you want to hear a good story from somebody.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, you don't want someone reciting their resume when you say, you know, tell me about yourself, what you do. You want to hear a story. Well, you don't want to hear, here's where I went to college. And then in 1982, we moved, you know.
That's right, yeah. So, and it's fascinating, isn't it? Because whether it's marketing or whether it's, you know, online in the internet space or whether it's other kind of business pursuits, we tend to stray away from common sense, what people actually like.
Well, a story offers many points of connection. And ultimately, that's what it's all about when you're presenting an innovation or any idea, really. It's about connecting. And, you know, Jürgen, you said it early on, and I want to underscore it. It's empathy. And that's storytelling is a point of connection. It's empathy. Breeds empathy. It's so important. I mean, especially in an era where we're technologically connected to more people than ever before, hence our chat right now.
Yeah.
But to be meaningfully connected to anyone or any endeavor, any task, any campaign, anything, you need empathy. And that comes from a story. We all have a story and we could share our stories. And I love stories. I'm an avid reader though. I always have been. And you know, there's just nothing to me like getting immersed in a great story or hearing a great story, you know, from at a dinner party or a conference. I was at a conference yesterday, you know, there are people droning on the same old thing. And then someone gets up and tells a great story and the whole room, you know, stands with attention. Just, you know, everybody looks up and looks away from their phones and they become quickly absorbed.
Yeah.
And it's still, and it will always be, you know, as long as man has and women have existed, that is how we connect with stories.
That's right. I think back to prehistoric age when, you know, before people could read and write, and that's how we learn. That's how things got passed down through the generations. Basically, it was storytelling, right?
Absolutely.
The campfire when the meals were, and the wild beasts or whatever they were chopped up and grilled. And, people told stories about, you know, and that's how we learned.
Well, my daughter, you know, probably one of the earliest meaningful conversations that we had began with "Mommy, tell me a story." You know, we're as humans, we crave it. We crave it.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It was same with our kids. I guess that, you know, the very early days when the challenge was to get them to sleep in bed when they were still not even walking, it was, okay, we'll read a story. And that did the trick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Absolutely.
All right, this has been absolutely fascinating, Christy. I really appreciate the time. I think we should move on to the buzz, which is our innovation round, and it's designed to help our audience, who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field, with some tips from your experience. So I've got five questions that hopefully you'll give us some really insightful answers to. I'm sure you will, and inspire everyone to go and do something awesome.
Okay. I'm ready.
Okay, good. So what's the number one thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Listen.
Yeah.
Love be it. Curious and really listen.
That's great advice. All right. What's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
Best thing I've done is be curious and listen. You know, it's not what else. I think being curious, just asking questions. Why? What if? how could this be different? How could this be better? How, you know, it's just, I'm really driven by curiosity in a big way. There's a one of my favorite sayings, it's a bit of my mantra, and that is curiosity is the cure for boredom. There is no cure for curiosity. It's Dorothy Parker.
Okay, yeah.
But I think curiosity is the greatest thing anyone can cultivate to be innovative.
Great advice. Just making a note of the Dorothy Parker quote. All right, so what's your favorite tool or system for improving productivity and allowing you to be more creative then?
So this may sound a little wacky, but it's list making. And
I love lists.
I love lists because, you know what, here's what happens. Something's in the back of my mind. I have some tasks I need to do at home, or I need to pick up my dry cleaner, or whatever. You know, just the multitude of tasks in our daily lives that we need to do, people we need to call, emails we need to send. If all of that is brewing in the back of my mind, then I'm not free to free associate and be creative. So, you know, it's sort of like when you're driving in your car and your mind wanders, sometimes that's very creative, or if you're in the shower and you're just, you know, your mind wanders and so you can be creative spontaneously. I find that if I make a list, then it liberates me from having to churn that thought over. Don't forget to pick up your dry cleaning. Don't forget to pick up your dry cleaning. Oh, you need to call your mother back. You know, whatever those nagging tasks are, if I put them down on paper, then I'm liberated from thinking about them. And therefore, I can think about other stuff.
That's fantastic advice. And I can totally relate to that. I don't find that strange at all, because I love my lists. So
it seems so simple and a little bit analog, doesn't it?
It is. Yeah, it is analog, but no, I sometimes do lists in picture form to try and get more visual, but definitely get things like remember the milk kind of stuff out of your head.
That's right.
Because then the mind can work on other things.
Yes.
All right. What's the best way, you know, to keep a client or a project on track?
Oh, keep a project on track.
Having good lists.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? It's so true. Yeah. I think that, you know, I'm going to sound like a broken record, but I think it's, again, it goes back to listening, you know, really checking, and this, you know, can be interpreted a lot of ways, checking in, you know, regular status, regularly communicating what's going on, listening to change, you know, where it's, the world's moving so fast, so change happens quickly, so to, you know, just constantly be listening to your clients or your team on what's going on, you know, at any given point. Just listen, never stop listening. I think it just keeps us all aware and focused and on point. I mean, you think about it, if you're not listening, you're distracted. And if you're not distracted, you're not productive. I mean, if you're distracted, you're not productive.
Yeah. You're just testing if we're listening, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's great advice. So I like the idea of, you know, the regular checking in, but checking in with the intent to listen again and what's changed. And great advice.
Yeah, sometimes it's the subtext you have to listen to also. So listen, right. Ask questions, ask lots of questions.
And be curious.
Yes, be curious. Yeah. So I think I'm a very simple woman.
So what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
Oh, wow. That's a challenging one. I believe that, I mean, I suppose it sounds crazy, but I really believe that we're all unique. And I think if you can celebrate your uniqueness and be confident about it, you know, there are times in my life where I've felt shame about, you know, I was a little barefooted redneck girl from Texas, and then I'm in the New York City all of a sudden, you know, with people who were far better educated than me and had far more, let's just say, gracious childhoods than I did. And I don't think I appreciated or celebrated my uniqueness. I had a very thick Texas accent, and I was a little self-conscious about that. So, you know, there are different periods in my life where I think many people have, you know, you feel like an imposter, you feel like you really shouldn't be there. And why is that? It's because you're not celebrating your uniqueness. So I think if you want to differentiate yourself, it's about just owning who you are and owning your experience and valuing that you have something to bring and something to contribute, and just believe in that.
That's great advice. That's great answer to that question. And I think, you know, one of the things I mentioned earlier about the mastermind course I'm doing with Seth Godin, and he kind of poo-poos the idea of the race to differentiate yourself, if you like. I'm not sure that that's reflecting it right, but he says, you know, differentiation is, and he comes back to the idea of empathy, but it's not about, you know, I'm the best at this, or I'm this, or trying to pretend to be something just to be different. So I think, you know, the answer of, you know, celebrating your own uniqueness and being confident about it and understanding what that uniqueness can contribute then to other people, I think is a great one too.
Well, you know what, try this one with Seth. It's about having empathy for yourself.
Mm.
And you know, it's self-care. It's accepting yourself and who you are. And who you are is unique. It's true. We don't have to, you know, you don't have to be, as he was saying, the best. And I understand exactly where he's going with that. But I try that with him and see what he thinks. I'd love to know. Right. I've never had the pleasure of talking to him. So.
All right. Well, I'll put that up on the discussion forums and see what happens. So what's the future for you then and for Womenkind, the business Womenkind?
Well, you know, it's hard to change the world, and it's a much slower process than I thought. You know, truly the future, I hope that you know, clients continue to find us and we continue to do good work and make a little bit of difference in the world. If, you know, one marketing campaign at a time, I find our work to be very meaningful, even though, you know, at the end of the day, we're just trying to sell stuff. But I really do want Womenkind to have a legacy of doing the right thing and improving and bringing more respect to women in the marketplace. That's my goal. I hope that we accomplish it. And you know, it's a work in progress. We you know, the Japanese have that philosophy of it, I think it's called Kitsu or something, and it's just 1% improvement a day. And that's what I hope to. That's what I hope. Just 1% improvement a day.
That's great. And just, yeah, and I can't remember who said this, but it's something that stuck in my mind. It's, if you make just a little bit of difference every day, you actually do change the world.
Yes, that's, and you know what, and feeling good about that little bit of difference, it doesn't, not every day is a massive day.
Yeah, that's right. All right. What's the number one piece of advice you'd give anyone, any business owner who wants to be a leader in innovation and in their field?
I don't know if I'm equipped to. I would say the one piece of advice is, gosh, what would I say? The one piece of advice if somebody wants to. I don't know. A couple of things. I would say stay focused on your one true mission. Try not to be distracted. Listen to others' input, but come back to your heart and just focus on that. I think creative people and entrepreneurs, you know, you hear about serial entrepreneurs and serial innovators, and, you know, it's our nature is to think about something differently all the time and really, you know, pursue. And I think we have to sacrifice that sometime in the interest of focus.
Mm.
I have millions of, I literally more ideas than I could ever execute in my life. And I have to force myself to sometimes say, you know what? We're not going to do that. We're going to do the thing we've been working on for 6 months, which, you know, trying to keep that interesting because, you know, when you're an innovator, you want to keep innovating. And sometimes you have to nurture those ideas and not leave them behind.
Yeah, and we all run distraction strategies and shiny object syndrome. So that's really great advice.
I need a distraction strategy. If you have one, tell me.
I've got lots of them, but most of them are not, well, they're pretty well all not serving me that well. They work against the focus.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. Hmm. Yeah, get focused on a distraction strategy that works.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Christy. This has been really fantastic. Where can people reach out and say thank you for what you've shared with us today?
Oh, well, my email is Christy, K-R-I-S-T-I, at womenkind.net.
All right.
And it's women, not woman. So
yeah,
sometimes people make that. Yeah, you didn't make it, but sometimes misspell it, you know. So it's Christy at womenkind.net.
Yeah, well, we'll have the link to your website and to your email in the show notes for the podcast so people can just click through, but it is women, W-O-M-E-N, kind.net.
Yes. You are so delightful, Jürgen. I really enjoyed this conversation. I really did.
All right. Well, before we leave, I do ask my guests at the end, who else would you like me to interview on a future Innova Buzz podcast and why?
Oh, well, since you're an Aussie gentleman, I would love to introduce you to another Aussie gentleman, but you might already know him. It's a big country, I know, but it's also a small world. Do you know Anthony Howard?
I've heard of Anthony Howard, but I don't know him.
Oh, well, I want to introduce you to Anthony Howard. He is the CEO Whisperer. And he's a brilliant man. And he is in, oh, goodness, I don't remember the name. It's a town. It's not far from Melbourne. But he has a beautiful book that he's written on leadership called Humanize, I think it's called. I'll get you the name. But I would love to introduce you to him.
Okay, well, that'll be great. Love an
introduction. I think you guys would get on like a house on fire.
Great. And Anthony, look out for an invitation from us, courtesy of Christy Faulkner.
All right.
So thanks so much for sharing your time and insights with us today. This has been a fascinating discussion, Christy. I've sort of loved where this has gone. It didn't go the way I expected it to, but that's fine because I think we really explored some interesting concepts and I love the mission you're on to kind of change everybody's awareness around, you know, stereotypes in advertising. So thanks again. I've enjoyed this immensely and I've got a whole page of notes here that I need to follow up on. I've learned a lot myself. I always love these podcasts because it feels like I'm getting a one-hour masterclass with somebody.
Well, I really appreciate the work you're doing too, Jürgen. It's wonderful.
I'm going
to tune in as often as I can.
Great. I appreciate that. So okay. I wish you all the best for the future of womenkind and let's keep in touch.
All right. Thank you so much, Jürgen. Bye.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed hearing from Christy as much as I did and also learnt a lot just like me. She certainly is a very inspiring person with a passion for making a change in the world of advertising and marketing and addressing blind spots that we all may have, probably do have, when it comes to relating to others. All the great ideas and tips that Christy shared with us can be found at innovabiz.com.au/Christy Faulkner. That is KristiFaulkner. KNER. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.com.au/Christy Faulkner. So that's where you'll find her contact information for getting in touch with Christy and also the links to the things that we spoke about in the episode. We'd love you to go to that post and leave us some comments underneath. Tell us what you got out of this episode and if there's something that you're going to do as a result. I really encourage you to share with us the changes that you might make as a result of what you've heard from Christy, because she is a change maker, she is a driver of change, and so I'd love to hear that she's having an impact with my audience. Now, Christy suggests that I interview Anthony Howard of the Confidea Group on a future podcast. Now, Anthony is actually in Australia, so that should be fairly easy to connect with Anthony. So, Anthony, look out for an email from us with an invitation to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Christy Faulkner. Thank you for listening to this episode of the InnovaBuzz podcast, and make sure you subscribe over on iTunes or Stitcher or Pocket Casts, wherever your favourite app is to consume podcasts. That way you'll never miss a future episode. And we'd love you to, particularly on iTunes, leave us a review there, because that does help us get found. It does help us share this information with a bigger audience, and also let us know how we're doing. If there's anything you'd like us to cover, questions you want us to address, or other guests that you'd like us to interview on future InnovaBuzz podcasts, please send those ideas to us and we'll see what we can do. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, if you don't innovate, you stagnate. So think big, be adventurous, and keep innovating.